The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. TIAA makes you a retirement promise, a promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
LinkedIn presents.
I'd like to think that figuring out how your brain works is more like finding your own lane than winning a race with it. Because at the end of the day, even if most neuroscience books have taken the one-size-fits-all approach that doesn't fit anyone very well, we now know that there are many different ways to be normal, and that these differences aren't necessarily better or worse. They're just different.
Hello there. This is The Next Big Idea Daily, and I'm your host, Michael Kovnat. And my brain isn't normal. Is yours? No offense, but I highly doubt it. There's really no such thing as a normal brain, since each of our brains has its own singular form and function, and no two of us think exactly the same way. As a rule, though, neuroscience focuses on how the average brain works in general, largely ignoring the idiosyncrasies that make each human brain unique. To counter that tendency, Chantel Pratt has written a book called The Neuroscience of You: How Every Brain is Different and How to Understand Yours. Chantel teaches psychology, neuroscience, and linguistics at the University of Washington, and her research has been profiled in publications like Scientific American, Psychology Today, and Science Daily. Our curator, Adam Grant, says Chantel has a rare, remarkable gift for making neurons sing and dendrites dance, and she's written the smartest, clearest, and funniest book I've ever read about the brain. Here she is.
Social neuroscience experiments have shown us that the more similarly two people's brains work, the more likely they are to be friends. This is probably because our brain's most instinctive ways of trying to understand another person is through mirroring. For instance, when we observe someone else's actions, our brains activate the motor programming regions that would be involved if we were to take that same action. Some have even argued that this is where empathy comes from. But what happens when the mind you're trying to understand is the product of a brain that doesn't work like yours? This can create misalignment because your assumptions about the engine that is driving a person to behave the way they're behaving are based on the way you work. Fortunately, there's another way of understanding others, one that is more effortful and involves conscious, explicit reasoning about what drives the behavior of someone else. Much like we can come to understand other things we can't observe directly, like quantum physics, we can build mental models of the invisible minds of others by reverse engineering them based on their observable behaviors. This skill, which is called creating a theory of mind, develops later in life and to differing degrees in different people. Remarkably, behavioral genetics research has shown that this way of understanding others is entirely learned. Parents and caregivers who are mind-minded, using language that shows that a person's behavior can be driven by their own unique mental states, are more likely to raise children who learn to reverse engineer the minds of others. Be more curious than judgmental about those who don't work like you. The thing is, even if you have the tools to understand why someone is behaving differently than you would if you were in their shoes, it doesn't mean that you'll be motivated to put in the effort to do so. In fact, our brains have a clever way of enhancing our motivation to put in this kind of work when we're forming our most evolutionarily important relationships. When we enter a committed romantic relationship, or during parent-child bonding, they release oxytocin, a neurochemical that seems to turn up the volume on socially relevant signals by enhancing their reward value in the brain. Unfortunately, a strong sniff of oxytocin isn't going to motivate us to understand others that are different, especially if they're not our family or love interests. In fact, research suggests that oxytocin actually increases our awareness of in-group and out-group differences, bringing us to feel more positively about people we think are like us and more negatively about those we perceive as other. But here's where curiosity research comes into play. According to a recent theory developed by Gruber and Ranganath, when faced with uncertainty, our brains first go through an appraisal phase in which they figure out whether seeking new information is safe or dangerous. feelings of curiosity arise because your brain determines that it's probably safe to explore this unknown space and learn something new. On the other hand, if you feel threatened, either physically or psychologically, your brain will shut down your desire to learn and explore, doing its best to move you away from the space that it believes is dangerous. So how might we nudge our brains towards feelings of safety when trying to understand the unexplored space of the mind of another, particularly if they are someone who thinks, feels, and behaves differently than we do? One possibility is to develop a better appreciation for the gap between reality as we experience it, our subjective realities, and the objective, ostensibly knowable world out there. And I hope that learning how different brains build different realities can get you to a place where you are curious about the mind of another, without necessarily feeling threatened about the correctness of your own way of thinking, feeling, and behaving. If I were to ask you what type of learner you are, you would probably respond using some variation of being a visual, verbal, or experiential learner. But the thing is, these labels really refer to how we prefer to learn by instructions. While the majority of the learning we do on a daily basis actually relies on trial and error. So to understand how your brain uses your life experiences to shape your unique ways of thinking, feeling, and behaving, we're going to need to talk about reinforcement learning. Here's how it works in a nutshell. As your brain learns to represent the environment around you, any space you're in, mentally or physically, is associated with any number of actions you might take. For those of you who are sports aficionados, you might think of this like a really complicated playbook for living. And as you move through life exploring these different options, your brain keeps a record of how it worked out. Was the outcome of the action you chose better or worse than expected based on your previous experiences? If so, it updates the expected value of that choice in the future. Your brain might also teach you to pay attention to certain features of the environment that are critical for understanding which decision is best. But here's the catch. Humans have two pathways in the brain that learn in parallel about the outcomes of your decisions. One that strengthens the connection between context and choices that work out better than expected, and another that weakens the connections between contexts and choices that work out worse than expected. And as you might guess, there are remarkable individual differences in the strengths of these two pathways in the human brain. As a result, some people move through life by learning almost entirely by carrot. These people learn quickly how to find the good things in life. When faced with two good options, a carrot learner will be incredibly good at deciding which of them is likely to be the most rewarding. However, if they find themselves in a place where there aren't any good options, they have a really hard time choosing the least bad one amongst them. On the other end of the spectrum are our stick learners. These people learn the most from their disappointments. To put it simply, the decisions of stick learners are more driven by avoiding things that suck than by chasing things that are great. And while a stick learner might have a hard time choosing between two good things, they are excellent at picking the least bad thing in an environment where every option is suboptimal. In other words, you want these stick learners with you in the event of a zombie apocalypse or even a global pandemic. And it turns out, our research has also shown that stick learners have an advantage when it comes to problem solving, simply because they are more likely to figure out when the strategy they're using isn't working. They know when their train of thought is on the wrong track, so to speak, and adjust accordingly. Different doesn't necessarily mean better or worse. Do you ever wonder why so many people feel driven to be better? Don't get me wrong, I also find it frustrating that my brain, with 86 billion neurons, give or take a few, can't do two things well at once. But here's something I've come to appreciate over my decades of studying differences. Our vertebrate brains have been evolving for hundreds of millions of years, hundreds of thousands of those in the Homo sapiens format. Now, I'm not necessarily trying to say that we've maxed out, but I will say that the ways we define success are narrow, especially given the broader range of problems our brains have been asked to solve to ensure our survival. Take reading for an example. Not only is reading central to functioning in modern society, it's the cornerstone of our educational systems. So for the estimated 15% of children who struggle to learn to read, it becomes a barrier to all of the other types of information that are delivered through texts. But most estimates suggest that humans only started using written languages about 5,500 years ago. That's pretty recent in evolutionary terms, and there's something interesting about how we got there. According to one theory proposed by Mary and Annette, the shift in human brain structure that led to the increasing verbal abilities, one that created greater structural and functional differences between the two hemispheres of our brains, works in part by shrinking or impairing our right hemisphere rather than strengthening our left. In fact, she argues that while the people with the strongest degree of left-dominant brain asymmetries might be at a lower risk for having reading difficulties, they have a correspondingly higher risk of struggling with the spatial and navigational skills that ensured our ancestors' survival before Google Maps was a thing. And speaking of maps, let me give you another example of differences that don't necessarily map on to better or worse, one in which we can watch brains adapting to the environments we put them in rather than making inferences about what they evolved for. This one is centered on the brains of London's taxi drivers, which became famous in the year 2000 when neuroscientist Eleanor Maguire discovered that their brains were different. Specifically, the area of the brain commonly associated with forming new spatial memories, the tail end of a region called the hippocampus, was bigger in these drivers than in controls matched for age and general intelligence. Now, this might make a bit more sense to you if I explain that in order to get a license to drive a taxi in London, you first have to pass a test that involves memorizing the layout of more than 20,000 streets in the Greater London area. People study for this test for years, but fewer than 50% of them pass. Clearly, the test weeds out people with brains like mine, that are all RAM and no hard drive, so to speak. So were these taxi drivers born with bigger brain regions that somehow allowed them to stuff all that spatial information into their memories? A follow-up study provided a resounding no for the answer. When neuroscientists scanned the brains of a new group of people who had just started studying for the test to see if they could predict who would ultimately pass or fail based on the size and shapes of their various brain regions, they had no luck whatsoever. In fact, one of the only things that predicted who would pass the test was the amount of time a person spent studying. And it was only after more than a year of studying, when their brains had been crammed full of all that information, that their hippocampi became bigger. So you can change your brain in some circumstances if you work hard enough. But does this mean you should? The answer strongly depends on what you want to do with it. For instance, when Maguire and her team compared the memories of taxi drivers in their study to another group with similar day jobs, London's bus drivers, they found a profile of relative strengths and weaknesses associated with the demands of each group's specific jobs. Not surprisingly, after memorizing thousands of maps and spending their days in different parts of the city, taxi drivers were better than bus drivers on tests that involved estimating the distance between familiar places in the City of London or recognizing the landmarks of the city. However, when it came to taking in new information, like remembering lists of words, the bus drivers did better than the taxi drivers. And there were also a number of tests that the two groups performed equally well on. Things that are central to most of our lives, like the ability to recognize faces or remember stories. And the moral of this story is that when the brains of taxi drivers adapted to be able to store the kinds of knowledge they needed for functioning, there was an observable cost to some of their memory systems. And I don't think you can objectively decide which type of brain is better or worse without considering what it is you're trying to do with it. I'd like to think that figuring out how your brain works is like this. It's more like finding your own lane than winning a race with it. Because at the end of the day, even if most neuroscience books have taken the one-size-fits-all approach that doesn't fit anyone very well, we now know that there are many different ways to be normal, and that these differences aren't necessarily better or worse. They're just different.
Okay, well, whatever type of brain you've got, listeners, I hope it's a little bit smarter after hearing those ideas from Chantel Pratt. And we're not done yet. I've got some more interesting ideas lined up for you tomorrow, courtesy of Amanda Montell, author of the new book, The Age of Magical Overthinking, Notes on Modern Irrationality. Amanda's going to explain our weird obsession with celebrities and other strange cognitive quirks of the contemporary mind. If you want to check that out sooner, you can find Amanda today in our Next Big Idea app. Check that out in your app store. I'm Michael Kovnat. Thanks for listening.